You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 1st, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, author Tracy McMillan on her book, The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. Also on the program today, at age 43, Andrew Breitbart dead. I will have some comments on it later in the program as I continue to form them in my mind. Rather shocking news, or perhaps maybe not so shocking. It never struck me as someone who is particularly healthy, but who knows? Also on the program today, Olympia Snow retiring from the Senate, but maybe not before she has a chance, or certainly not before she has a chance, to vote for the Blunt Amendment. Blunt Amendment, which would essentially say that employers can basically on a whim determine that they're not going to provide certain health care coverage for their employees. So, for instance, hypothetically speaking, let's pretend I provided health insurance for Matt. And I thought, you know, Matt, this whole thing where you get painkillers for the surgery you had, there's a lot of hypotheticals here. But I just think that that's weak. So, no prescription painkillers for you. So this is going through, and we all know what it's about. It is about punishing women for having sex, essentially. That isn't strictly for procreative purposes. And this is very consistent with the conservative mindset. They are still reacting to the notion that women have some measure of emancipation in the context of the workforce. Now, that doesn't mean that they have equal pay. They've been quite successful at preventing that. But the fact of the matter is that a woman who has the ability to determine whether or not she gets pregnant has far more power in the marketplace and in society in general. They have control over their own fate. Now, I know some of the conservatives out there saying, well, they do have a chance to control it. They can just hold that aspirin in between their legs. Well, that's exactly the point, that I am actually explicitly arguing that it's okay for women to have sex without the point of that sex being to procreate. And I even will extend that. Well, I don't extend it, but I believe that my daughter will have that right when she gets into her 30s or late 40s. So we've got to take a break. When we come back, we will be talking to Tracy McMillan. And later in the program, I will have my comments about the death of Andrew Breitbart.
I turned my camera on, I cut my fingers on the way slipping away. I turned my feelings on, you made me untouchable for life. Yeah, yeah, and you wasn't alone. It hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton. No, 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 no. Ooh, yeah. Well, I turned my feelings on. I turned my feelings on inside.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Tracy McMillan. She is a resident of Brooklyn, author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table, a winner of several national awards, including the Harry Chapin Media Award. And has been published in the New York Times, Harper's, Slate, and more. Welcome to the program, Tracy.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tracy, let's basically your book. You basically went undercover for about 6 months to sort of track food from the point of it being grown. And as it's distributed via, I guess, the world's biggest supermarket, maybe? Is that possible that Walmart is that? And also Applebee's. Tell us first about your experiences in the fields.
Sure. So I went and got work as a harvest worker in California's Central and Salinas Valleys. So the place where I spent the most time was in the Salinas Valley, where I was harvesting garlic. And for that, right, you just sort of show up in the dark before dawn in your sort of farm worker outfit and sort of get in line and say, yep, I want to work today. And you just sort of get work that way. And so I was earning $1.60 for every 5 gallon bucket of garlic I could pick. So that's one of those construction buckets you get at Home Depot. And being paid piece rate legally, piece rate work is required to be equivalent to or exceed minimum wage. So if somebody doesn't pick enough, the employer, usually a farm labor contractor, is responsible for making up the difference. That did not happen in my case. So say on my first day I had 10 buckets. I left, you know, at the end of the day with a card saying I got there at 5:30. I left at 2:30, right? So I had about 8-9 hour day, and that I had picked 10 buckets. My paycheck basically would say that, you know, I earned $16 and then divide it by minimum wage, which is 8 in California, and would say on my payroll check that I had worked for 2 hours that day, even though they knew and I knew that I had been there for 8 or 9 hours. And this was something that happened with everybody I was working with. Almost everybody that I met that was working as a harvest worker was undocumented, and so those workers were not in a position to feel comfortable complaining, because for them it's more important to have stable employment than it is to just worry about getting paid a fair wage.
So I mean, was it possible to pick? I mean, I guess it's possible, but you'd have to be an amazing picker, really, to sort of to make considerably over the minimum wage.
I would say so. Everybody that I worked with, the most that anybody, even the strongest, burliest guys that have been doing this for a long time, everybody pretty much agreed you could not pick more than 4 buckets in an hour, and you would require 5 in order to make the minimum wage. So, like, wow. I obviously am weak and inexperienced, and so I was particularly bad at that. I have heard from other workers since that if you are in a really good field with really big heads of garlic, you can do 5 or 6 in an hour, but that it really depends on the fields. And obviously, you know, I spent a couple of months doing this work. I'm not an expert, you know, by any stretch of the imagination. And so it's possible that in some fields you can earn minimum wage. I know that it did not seem to be possible for anybody I was working with to earn minimum wage.
Now, you are the only, were you essentially the only Caucasian in that field? Were you the only legal worker there?
So far as I could tell, in terms of the harvest crews, yes. Usually the supervisors and the foremen and forewomen, those are often people who have legal status in the country, and usually they're still working in farm work because of language barriers and because it's, you know, if you've built a decent life with that, it's pretty easy to just sort of continue in that industry and doing that kind of work. It's possible that I saw a very sunburned redhead man in one field, but I didn't go up and talk to him, so I don't know if he was actually, a lot of folks from northern Mexico are actually quite light-skinned, and I actually have some Hispanic heritage and have very dark hair and very dark eyes, so I can pass, you know, for someone from Latin America if I'm considered one of the white people there.
Now, how did you choose? What, was it the Garlic Company? Is that the name of it? What was the name of the company you were working for?
Right. So I actually was employed by a farm labor contracting company, which is how a lot of farms deal with harvest labor, is that instead of employing workers directly, they just go to a farm labor contractor and say, bring us workers, and you take care of all the paperwork. You're responsible for minimum wage. You're responsible for immigration papers. You're responsible for all of that stuff. So I was working for El Bajio Contracting. The garlic that was being picked, though, however, was going to two companies, the Garlic Company, which is based in Gilroy, and the Garlic Company, which is based in Bakersfield. And they sort of market to different audiences. So Christopher Ranch is a higher-end brand. You see a lot of it in Whole Foods, both as whole bulb garlic and as processed garlic. The Garlic Company does a lot more work dehydrating garlic into garlic powder as well as fresh bulb and minced and all of that. And I actually, when I was working at Walmart later, found myself stocking the heads of garlic that had come in from the Garlic Company. Although due to the time of year, it was actually stuff that the Garlic Company had imported from Argentina. So it wasn't my garlic.
Well, but I mean, now, so who is theoretically responsible for making sure that the workers are getting paid what they should be getting paid? I mean, is there any safeguards here? I mean, was there I don't want to say it's incompetence because it's obviously not incompetence. There's a willful neglect of laws here. But at what point in the system is it supposed to catch the system, or is the system just designed so that there's really no culpability here?
Right. Well, I mean, there are laws on the books, and particularly in California. California has some of the strongest farm labor protections in the country, and they're simply, for the most part, not enforced. And to be fair, right, finding the kinds of labor violations that I experienced is incredibly detail-oriented and takes a lot of work. So, California Department of Labor investigations on farms usually turn up violations of workers' compensation, so like companies not holding workers' comp insurance. And the reason that most of the inspections turn that up is because that is something where the inspector shows up at the field, asks for a certificate, and if it's not there, they can just write them up a ticket for that. Something like what I was experiencing, not only do you need to have workers that feel empowered to complain, like you need an inspector that's going to go to the office of the company and ask to see all the field cards and sit there and do the math to show that the field cards are not matching up to the paycheck. And a lot of it, right, is that right now most labor inspections are based on complaints. Like there are not labor inspectors roaming around California fields just checking, right? And so why would you do that, right? Like, that would be really hard to do. And if workers aren't complaining, right, which is what happens when you have an undocumented workforce, you know, how are you going to catch that? It's really, really hard. And a lot of it is, you know, a lack of resources, you know, for labor inspection and a lack of sort of, you know, like political will to make that a big deal and to enforce really high fines so that, you know, if you get caught, it's really honestly not worth it. You know, I talk to a lot of growers and they all tell me, oh, you would never cheat workers because it would be terrible for your, you know, your public relations. But, you know, the average fine levied under the Agricultural Worker Protection Act is $342. I was cheated out of about $480 in like my 4 weeks of work. So it's, you know, there's an advocate that I quote in the book who told me, you know, farm labor in the U.S., it's sort of this the exploding pinto theory of labor management. It is cheaper to break the law than it is to follow it. And if you don't make growers and farm labor contractors think they'll get in trouble, like, they're not going to follow the law.
Yeah, we see that now. It is not just with the Pintos, it's also with the banking industry. We're seeing that across a lot of different, I mean, I think that's
right.
The story of regulation, frankly, in this country,
right.
More often than not these days. And you had a stat that if wages were increased by how much it would, there was an amazing stat that showed that how little it would impact American families if workers were paid just significantly more wages.
Right. So this is a statistic that comes from an economist at UC Davis, Philip Martin. So he does a lot of work around farm labor and the cost of farm labor. Farm labor is a tiny fraction of the price of food at the store. It's a big price for the farmer, but there's so much else that goes into food before it gets to the store, right? So it's a tiny fraction. And so Martin had calculated that by increasing farm worker wages by 40%, which would be taking the average farm worker wage from about $10,000 a year to $14,000, that would result in an increase in the average American family's grocery bill of about $16 a year, right?
Wow.
So this is not a huge, right? There tends to be this argument, particularly from growers, that, well, if we increase the cost of labor, like, people will not be able to afford food. And there's actually very little to back that up in terms of, you know, actual social science.
All right, so let's move on to, and then you went to, how long were you working in the fields?
Yeah, so I worked in the fields off and on for actually about 3 months because I did a sort of an initial sort of test run that I ended up writing about the book because it was so powerful, like what I had learned in the fields just in that test run, and then spent just under 2 months looking for work and then working in the Central and Salinas Valleys.
Did you find anybody in the fields who had, I mean, did you have conversations that were broader than what you were doing? In other words, did you ever come across anybody who said, like, you know, who had a notion of a larger picture, of a sense of reform? I mean, I imagine most people are just like, I just want to pick my garlic and I want to get as much money as I can and I want to get out of here. And they're not thinking about systemic issues. But did you ever have any type of interactions like that or no?
I definitely had some interactions where folks, you know, people understand that they're getting screwed,
right?
So it's not that they're like, oh, I don't care how much I'm making. You know, they sort of accept that that's sort of their position in life right now, but they understand that they're not being paid fairly and that they're being cheated.
But, I mean, is there any impetus there that people are saying, I mean, did you ever come across, I'm just curious because I'd be surprised if you did, but if there was any type of impetus of somebody saying, like, we need to organize. In other words, I imagine most people who are working in that situation want to get out of that situation if there's any, you know, to the extent that they can expend extra energy beyond what they're doing, it would be to sort of find a better situation rather than making that situation better.
Right. Well, I actually did meet both the family that I lived with and one of the families that I befriended in the fields. Both had actually been involved in some degree of community organizing to try and improve wages and improve their living conditions in the community they were in. It's important to remember them. The communities I was in are extremely recent immigrants, so we're talking people that have come up within the last 10 years, usually indigenous immigrants who have very limited education, most of the adults, so the people that actually in terms of age are my peers, have less than a sixth grade education.
Mm-hmm.
So those are folks that are not going to sort of easily and readily move into a more highly skilled, you know, like, set of work. You know, these are intelligent people, but they're not people that have learned much beyond basic math and basic literacy in Spanish. So, you know, there is an interest and concern in advocating and agitating for better work conditions, but they're usually hamstrung by the fact that they don't have papers, and so their employment is often contingent on them being quiet.
All right, let's move to Walmart. And you worked at Walmart in the produce section for a couple of months?
Yeah, so actually what had happened is I initially took a position, and this sort of belies, you know, the fact that I've generally worked in the independent sector, nonprofit sector, not a corporate one. I took a job on the night shift stocking the baking aisle during the holiday season at a Walmart outside of Kalamazoo, thinking that I would transfer pretty quickly to produce. And then, as with most companies, Walmart has a requirement that you spend 6 months in one position at the same store before you're allowed to transfer. And due to actually my personal economics, which was that I didn't have enough money to sort of really just work at Walmart, you know, indefinitely until I could transfer. I left that position on good terms and then came back a few months later and got a position at a Walmart outside of Detroit working in the produce section. So I did sort of both grocery stocking and produce stocking. And in total, I spent about 8 to 10 weeks working and looking for work at Walmart.
Wow. And the thing that really struck me was that you basically figured out the key to the way that Walmart does it is that they – it's the processed food that is completely is discounted, and the produce is basically, on some level, it seems like a ripoff a little bit because they seem to keep, it's not that fresh.
Right. I mean, and that's a criticism, to be fair, that can be made of almost any major grocer.
Right.
Right. Because the way that, right, I make this point in the book, like the history of supermarkets is that they didn't exist until industrial agriculture and industrial food processing really came into their own in the 1910s and 1920s. And then supermarkets started because all of a sudden you could do these industrial economies of scale with food, which beforehand were just not possible. And so, you know, that sort of thing with, you know, produce not being super fresh, that's something that really has, you know, you'll find at almost any grocer. I would suspect that a lot of grocery stores and quite possibly other Walmart grocery stores besides the one in which I worked do a better job with produce, right? So I think one of the reviewers was talking about the discussion of the produce section, and he said it was sort of like a catch-22 comedy of errors, right? Because I just was working in this produce section that was managed just incredibly ineptly. And in part because the store had hired a 20-year-old from the electronics department to be the produce manager and clearly didn't give him sufficient training to manage, you know, this incredibly complicated system of, you know, having 500 items that are all in the process of rotting, right, and sort of rotating them through and figuring out how to keep things fresh without losing too much of your stock and all of that. So it's a very complicated system.
And so what was basically the biggest lesson that you learned from your experience there in terms of I mean, what did you set out when you worked at Walmart, what did you set out to sort of find? And was it what you ultimately found?
Right. So I basically wasn't going out with like a really strong hypothesis. I more was thinking, you know, I want to see how this works and I want to see how Walmart handles produce because it is the biggest food supplier in the U.S. and the world and in the history of the U.S., right? So Walmart right now controls about 25% of the food supply in the country, and that's a nationwide average. So in many, many communities, including 29 major metropolitan areas, it controls more than 50% of the food retail, and in small towns, it's often, you know, actually the only game in town. So if you have a supplier that's that strong and has that much control over how America eats, I really wanted to see what it looks like, right, on the ground and how it all works. And so, you know, we talk so much about Walmart's efficiencies and their economies of scale, and in my experience on the ground, there is not that much efficiencies. And one thing that was really interesting to learn was that prices at Walmart, particularly for healthy food, are not really any better than you'll find at your local supermarket. And oftentimes Walmart is more expensive on those items because it can't do the same kinds of economy of scale that it can for its processed food.
Interesting. So let's turn to Applebee's.
Mm-hmm.
This, I gotta say, you know, I mean, I don't go to Applebee's that often. I think only basically probably when we go back to Michigan to visit my in-laws. And maybe even then, I don't know if we've been more than once or twice over the years. But I was sort of shocked to find out how Applebee's cooks their food.
Oh, really? So, you know, this is interesting because I'm actually from Michigan, and so I came up, one of my first jobs was at a Big Boy, so I sort of was like, oh, this is kind of the same deal. Like, I would think of Applebee's as being a nicer place, but, you know, most of the stuff at Applebee's comes in pre-made in terms of sauces, soups, anything that can be processed pretty much is, you know, with the exception, you know, meats on the grill, right, are defrosted and then cooked fresh.
Right.
Other than the ribs. The ribs are smoked and seasoned and all that offsite, and then we just heat them up on the grill. Pasta is cooked, you know, within a few days of when it's being served. So it's portioned, it's cooked, you know, in large batches in the back. It's portioned out into plastic bags, and then the cooks will, like, microwave it to, you know, heat it up for service. So all that stuff, like, to me wasn't super shocking, but what for me, right, the big shocker was that, you know, all that portioning means that most of the food is reheated in plastic bags, and then you have this concern about, like the safety of the food, because there's often, like, the plastic bags will degrade, and I write about this, right? My job in the kitchen was to basically manage the flow of food between the line, right, which is where everything is cooked, and going out to the floor. So my job would be to empty out the bags of sides, and plastic bag would flake out over the food very frequently.
So wait a second. Are you suggesting that eating a plastic bag that's been radiated in a microwave is not healthy?
That would be my suspicion. I haven't, you know, followed up on a lot of the health science with that, but I, you know, I was sort of like, you know, if I looked at the plate and I saw those flakes on here, I would think it was salt, right? And I would mop that up. And I think consuming petroleum products usually is not recommended. You know, I don't know that that's actually any violation of any health standard, right? But it seems like common sense that you don't eat plastic.
I mean, do they have, like, like, is there a sign in the back at Applebee's like, hey, if you see any plastic bag in the food, make sure you take it out? I mean, like, do they recognize this is an issue at all? Or it's just like, do they get complaints about it? I mean, nothing,
I mean,
right?
It's not big chunks of plastic bags, right? It's like little flakes. So it sort of just makes these little snowflakes out over the food. Often they'll melt pretty quickly, and it's not something you would necessarily taste. And I should also say, right, like, I do not have enough of a handle on Applebee's supply chain, and you know, I did call Applebee's and try and get them to talk to me about their supply chain. They're very protective of that. It's entirely possible that they have some sort of food-safe grade bag that it isn't a problem to ingest. I have no reason to think that that's the case, and I don't think that's what's going on. I have not vetted that. So if Applebee's, you know, comes back and says that's actually something made out of an entirely edible product, like, then fine, you know, mea culpa, I got it wrong. But I certainly wouldn't feel like, now when I go out to eat at any place that's sort of in the same genre as Applebee's, I don't get anything that could be reheated in a plastic bag.
And so why did you go to Applebee's? I mean, I'm curious, as opposed to any other part of the chain. I mean, like, you know, Walmart seems, I can understand that decision, obviously, going into the field. But why Applebee's, of all places?
Right. So both Walmart and Applebee's are the largest providers of their particular service. So, right, Walmart's the biggest grocer. Applebee's is the largest casual sit-down chain. And I wanted to do something that most Americans had visited, right? Like, I wanted to look at how America actually really eats, not how we think they should or not how we suspect they do, right? But something where I'm like, okay, well, a lot of people have eaten at Applebee's, right? And it is actually the largest casual dining sit-down restaurant in the U.S. and the world, right? And it's important to remember most of the restaurants in the U.S. are actually independent. So there's, you know, a number of sort of big national chains, but there's, like, this sort of infinite number of little mom-and-pop restaurants and independently owned fine dining and places and things like that. So Applebee's I can't remember the statistic off the top of my head, but, you know, Applebee's still only I know that it's less than 5% of restaurant sales in the U.S., even though it's the biggest one.
Right.
That mostly represents the fact that almost all restaurants in the U.S. are individual.
It was interesting, and I think you're one of the sort of the broader conclusions you made was that we have to deal with these issues of the way that people eat more on a policy level than in sort of asking people just, hey, change your habits, because it's just not quite that easy, is it?
Right. It's not that easy, and it's also it's not that effective, right? Like, that's the strategy that we've been using, at least since I was a kid, with my pyramid and my plate, and sort of saying, like, hey, everybody, eat this way. It's been failing us, right? Like, obesity has been going up and up and up, so maybe we need to sort of take a different approach. And what I sort of felt like as I went through that project was just that, you know, most people that I met, if you talk to them about what they thought was good, they understood eating fruits and vegetables was important. They understood that cooking was a good way to keep costs down and still eat healthfully, and they just very honestly felt like they didn't have, like, the tools or the time or the access or the money. And so I think if we're going to start telling people you need to spend more time and money on your food, we've got to think about, like, well, do they have enough money and do they have enough time to really do that? And that's a question about wage stagnation and work life as much as it's any, like, discussion about cooking.
Tracy McMillan, the book is The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we got to take a break. And when we come back, We'll be talking to Jeff Smith from the Occupy Wall Street media team. He's got a piece out in the Daily Beast about how Russell Simmons... Well, I guess let me read the title. From Russell Simmons to Ben and Jerry, the would-be sponsors of Occupy Wall Street. Let's get an update from Jeff Smith, both on his piece in the Daily Beast and the actions that took place yesterday and the actions that we're anticipating. M1, they're calling it, folks. Just around the corner. We'll be right back after this.
One day is fine and next is black. So if you want me off your back, well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. Decisions bugging me.
Decision, they molest me.
If you don't want me, set me free.
Set me free.
Exactly who I'm supposed to be. Don't you know which clothes even fit me? Come on and let me know.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone, Jeff Smith from, well, writer for the Daily Beast and also a member of the media team down at Occupy Wall Street. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Give us an update on what took place yesterday in at least in New York City. There were actions across the country yesterday. Tell us what happened in New York.
Well, the focus of what was going on was about it was called Shut Down the Corporations, and it was actually a call that came out of Portland. And there were a number of cities all over the country that were all focused around specifically the corporations that have been involved in ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which I know you've covered and have done a lot of work on. And so it was particularly the, you know, biggest and most sinister corporations that are basically using our government as a proxy to pass their own laws and basically use as their own corporate infrastructure. And so we met at Bryant Park, and from there, actions were staged targeting these specific institutions, such as Bank of America and Pfizer, and in other cities around the country, tobacco companies were targeted, and, you know, large industrial or rather agricultural conglomerates, things like that. But basically, it was just another in a long series of attempts to call attention to really serious issues in this country that the regular, you know, not surprisingly, corporatized media is not really that interested in covering. And so in addition to the marches and actually trying to protest in front of some of these companies, we also had Matt Taibbi out at Bryant Park, and he gave a little impromptu teach-in and talked about some of the issues. So there's both actions as well as education there. And as far as what actually happened in New York, it turned into another scenario where the police basically preempted virtually everything we tried to do. So in instances where we tried to get in front of Bank of America just to perform some street theater and to make a point about what's going on, they preemptively had the entire block barricaded from every side. And the police were out in huge numbers, and they even made some just sort of random arrests. They grabbed one person was dressed as a clown as part of this street theater, and they just arrested and, you know, hauled away a clown. So, you know, it's definitely about intimidation here in New York, but I think certainly that the protest is undeterred, and these are the types of things that we're going to continue to talk about and continue to take to the streets.
What are the charges for dressing like a clown in New York? Is that a... Is that a jesting without license, or what is the official charge?
I'm not sure. They can pretty much call anything disorderly conduct, but No, I'm not really really sure. I mean, clearly the Fox studios would be, you know, overrun by NYPD if acting like a clown were clearly illegal in this city.
Nice. Well, all right. So, what are people? Is there? I mean, you know, it's always in the background that the next biggest action. Or the biggest action that people are anticipating over the next couple of months is going to be M1. Have you heard any more of plans of May 1st? Are there subsidiary protests that are going to be taking place prior to then? What can you tell us on that to that extent?
Definitely the primary planning right now is for May 1st. There's going to be part of it that will be happening in cities throughout the country, and particularly on the first day of May, May 1, you're going to see a concerted action throughout the country that's going to have a similar theme. But then there's also the GA and the NATO conferences in Chicago. And for a lot of people, also converging on Chicago in the month of May is also going to become an important action. So I don't know that it will be literally for the entire month of May, as Adbusters called for, because a lot of people definitely are planning things for May 1st in their home cities. But I think for the actual weeks of those conferences in Chicago, you're going to see a lot of people mobilizing. I'm pretty sure I'm going to be heading up there for that time period myself. And you'll really see, you know, what a national movement starts to look like. I mean, there have been other calls to group nationally as an Occupy movement, but I think come May, and because, you know, the NATO and G8 conferences and summits in general always attract a certain type of protest, that I think you're going to really see it escalate, and that we're going to see what happens when enough force comes to bear against the response that we've seen in the past at these types of events.
You're planning to head to Chicago in May?
Yes.
And
not for May 1st, but for the G8 and for the NATO summits, yes.
Interesting. And is there any talk of making creating another sort of occupied, like a central, like physical location for the movement, let's say in New York?
In terms of an encampment, another camp,
right.
An outdoor occupation? Certainly. I mean, I think that we are continuing to, you know, explore the legal possibilities of what that would take, as well as making sure that we have the size and the ability to do it. I think there have been a couple of other attempts that have not been quite as well attended and thus not as well executed. But, we know that this is no longer a sort of surprise tactic, and that if we try and set up this sort of encampment again, that the forces are going to want to clear it out much more quickly and have less tolerance for it. So the way to pull it off is going to have to require either a lot more people or a different kind of tactic that they're not waiting for.
And so tell me about the Occupy Money Group. You wrote about this in Daily Beast today. Tell me, who is the Occupy Money Group, and what is it?
Well, this is a group, and the current name is now Movement Resource Group. But this has essentially been a group of wealthy donors that have been sitting in the back and have watched Occupy Wall Street develop. And they definitely see something here that's different than they've been able to organize, or that really any progressive professionals have been able to put together. And frankly, it feels like they want a piece of that. They want, you know, what very rich people see in the world are opportunities, and mostly they think that they can buy those opportunities. And sadly, it seems like there's, you know, it's indicative of that bubble, of that privilege that they live in, that they wouldn't even realize that coming to a group like Occupy Wall Street and laying out a structure where they're saying, we're going to be the head, we're the board, we're going to make all the decisions, and we're going to give you guys money to, you know, fund Occupy Wall Street, just doesn't work. And in fact, it flies strictly contrary to everything this movement's about. And so the idea that we would somehow defeat capitalist institutions by recreating them is in some ways absurd. And yet these same rich people seem to be coming, and they don't want to hear that answer. They don't want to hear that's not how we operate. If you want to give us money, no strings attached, that's fine. But when you start saying you have to have an office and you have to fill out these forms and report to us and we decide what's an appropriate message versus what's an inappropriate message, then, you know, you've just created Move On or, you know, Van Jones' latest operation, and we really don't need that. And so that's basically what's come to bear here. And it really all comes out of the fact that it is true that people do need money. And what it feels like is that now the movement's in a place where people are a little bit more stretched thin and they're worried about how they're going to be able to make ends meet. And it feels like these people have come in as opportunists to try and take advantage of that. And that's, unfortunately, the response that I think a lot of these guys got in the meeting last Sunday, and they didn't particularly enjoy it. Rich people don't like to be addressed with the truth. And so, in a weird way, it feels like it's recreated many of the same power dynamics that Occupy Wall Street's protesting, you know, at the world at large.
And so, you know, let me see if I get what they're trying to do. They're setting up this group that's got $300,000. They're going to give out grants if you go through a granting process. And the reason why they're doing it this way is ostensibly because even though there is a multiple channels in which to fund Occupy, I mean, there's you know, whether it's supply the occupiers through Fire Dog Lake, or whether it's directly at OccupyWallStreet.org, or whether it's different WePay accounts or whatever, they want to centralize it, ostensibly, I guess, because this gives assurances to the donors, these wealthy donors, that their money's going to be well spent. Is that the theory?
I guess. I mean, the point is more that they get to decide what the message is, what the action is, what you actually do with that money ahead of time, instead of saying, you know, hey, we trust this movement. You guys are creative. You act autonomously. And sometimes the ideas are good, some are bad. But the real energy of the entire movement came out of that autonomy. And so to, you know, reconstruct it as a hierarchy, because the structure is such that there's a board of 10 people, and 5 of those people are the wealthy donors, and the other 5 are representatives of Occupy that those wealthy people choose. So it's, you know, we're talking about picking winners and losers, essentially. And so some people are going to become core organizers or main players within this structure. And like I said, that just feels like a structure that we've had in place for many, many years, and we know how effective that is. And so if you want to take advantage of what is special about Occupy Wall Street, you can't, you know, destroy that very special thing and just call it Occupy Wall Street. And that really seems like what these people want to do, is just buy the naming rights, because otherwise they're free to develop any kind of, you know, activist organization that they want. I'm not telling them they can't do what they want with their money.
Right, of
they
course.
They can't claim that. Exactly.
Well, do you think that they're, I mean, I think that these people are sincere on some level. You know, I've worked with Danny Goldberg when he was CEO of Air America. I think that there's a sincerity there, but I also do think that there is a problem on the left with the left money. You know, you just had the Democracy Alliance basically dump even what I would consider mainstream progressive organizations for so-called progressive organizations that are closely allied with the White House. And there is this notion of, you know, as much as those big donors on the left want to give money, they, at the end of the day, just do not trust the power in the hands of those who are actually out there doing stuff. I mean, you know, the right, I think, deserves credit. Maybe it's also because they just have so much more money, but they just shower that money, you know, instead of trying to sort of direct it and control every single dollar. But let me ask you this. So with that in mind, that's my perspective. Do you think from your interactions with this organization that they're just, are they doing this? What is their motivation? I mean, do you think they're trying to co-opt it? Do you think that they just want the press? Or do you think that there's just sort of a an inability for them to get beyond what they see their money should be able to buy? That was a great question, but apparently we lost Jeff. Hold on.
That was really good.
So, Jeff, are you there? Jeff, you there?
Yeah.
When did you lose me, buddy?
Right. I got most of it.
Well, basically, I was asking about three things. Do you think this is a function of this group wanting to get press? Do you think it's there's an intent to co-opt the movement, or do you think that it's they just don't they are just somewhat oblivious to or they just have a sort of a weird perception of what their money should be able to buy?
I think it's part of the latter, in that when Ben came to the band of Ben and Jerry's came to Zuccotti Park, and he was scooping ice cream and involved in the entire festivities there. And I think you were there, anyone that went there, felt the special vibe that was there. There was something incredible about the energy in that park. And I think when a really rich person sees or feels something like that, they want to buy it. They want to know, how do I get that? That's something that I've never been able to produce with my money, and how can I get that? And I don't think it necessarily is a bad intention, but I think there is definitely a sense of privilege, or they come from a point of privilege that makes them think that. And the other is that, the system that selects for these people becoming really wealthy is a system of self-promotion. And, what Ben and Jerry's ice cream is really them promoting themselves, not really the ice cream. And that became a huge phenomenon. So you're talking about someone whose skill is that art of self-promotion. And I think Russell Simmons and Alec Baldwin and virtually any rich person you can think of has a similar skill, as opposed to someone who invented something maybe, or, has a product. And for that reason, I think it's hard for them to give up that, that one skill. And so when they come to something like Occupy Wall Street, it's really hard to make that, something that's so selfless, that's not about in any way self-promotion. And it's really hard to connect with that and hook into that. And even though those people have been told there's no VIPs here, it doesn't matter how much money you give, I just think that they're too invested in being that VIP. And, I would like to say that it's an unconscious thing, but at some point I think you have to know that it's conscious. And the fact that the right-wingers are a little bit more out front about their motives, I think, that's what, as you say, makes it more sinister and makes it almost more of a threat from the left when these people come in and try and do this.
Interesting. The piece will be posted at majority.fm. Jeff Smith, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot. And I'm looking forward to, we talked about Andrew Breitbart a little bit last week, and in some ways I feel a little guilty. I feel like, did Occupy Wall Street do this to him? So I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts on Andrew Breitbart. And, in all honesty, it's never a happy thing when someone passes away. And so I definitely want to pay, respects on that level, because, he was more fun to beat up, when he was alive. Now, we'll just have to remember him. But thanks a lot, Sam, for everything.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
All right, folks. So let's talk about Andrew Breitbart. First off, I think it's a horrible tragedy when any children are orphaned, and apparently had four kids. I think it's four kids. I didn't know Andrew Breitbart in any personal way. I mean, I knew him. We had one exchange in person and a lot of exchanges over Twitter. As a human being, well, let me put it this way. I feel bad for his kids. I feel bad for his wife. It is always sad when people lose someone who's important to them in their life. And I have no idea. I'm going to assume that he was a good father and that he was a good husband just because. Because I have no evidence to the contrary. But the reason why I'm saying the words Andrew Breitbart have nothing to do with the fact that he was a father or a husband. The reason why I know the name Andrew Breitbart is for what he did publicly and what he was in terms of an icon and what he represented. And, you know, history can decide that. I suspect history is going to forget about him in about 6 to 8 months. But my experience of Andrew Breitbart was that he was a fairly petty guy who was smart about self-promotion, very good at attacking people's reputation, had very little integrity as a journalist. And what's the proof for that? I mean, I don't know if he considered himself a journalist. Let me put it this way. He had very little integrity as a disseminator of information. And how can I establish that? Simply look at the initial reactions to the posting on his website that he had died. Whether you were on the left, whether you were a mainstream journalist, whether you were a even on the right, people thought it was a hoax. People didn't even trust his own obituary or a notice that he had died on his own website. What does that tell you about his legacy? It tells me about his legacy that he wasn't someone to be trusted with the information that you get. And as far as respect for people who die, like I say, if I thought that, well, I don't know. I mean, his wife and his children are not watching this. But people who may have some brief experience with his legacy or his work might be. And so I think it's important to keep the record straight. In fact, I think that he would think it was important to keep the record straight. Now, when Ted Kennedy died, Andrew Breitbart said, "I'm more than willing to go off decorum to ensure this man is not beatified." Sorry, he destroyed lives and he knew it, referring to Kennedy. He called him a villain. He called him a big-ass motherfucker. He called him a duplicitous bastard and a prick. And he said, "I'll shut my mouth for Carter. That's just politics. Kennedy was a special pile of human excrement." Now, regardless of my personal sense of what Breitbart was, I'm not going to do that because I don't have the same standards that Breitbart did. And frankly, you know, I think there are certainly people out there who, if they died, I would have little hesitation saying that they were bad people who really hurt a wide range of people. You know, Dick Cheney comes to mind. I don't think Breitbart hurt that many people. I think he did hurt some people. I think he, but I don't think that he was some type of supervillain. I don't think he had that power. I think he was a guy who was funded by the right. He got some people fired. He called people racist. He was a web entrepreneur. I don't think people deserve to die for that. And so I'm not in any way joyous about his death. But at the same time, I think we should just call a spade a spade And I think Andrew Breitbart's work speaks for itself. And his tweets live on. And, you know, he had already blocked me on Twitter, so I won't necessarily miss engaging with him on Twitter. I had already mourned that. But, you know, I do feel bad for his kid and his kids and his wife. And just like I lament, but, you know, and I hope that it turns out that his cause of death was natural, whatever that meant, because I know the low regard people like Rick Santorum have when it was Whitney Houston died. And I know how much, you know, Breitbart claimed that he didn't have any type of substance abuse. Maybe he had a heart attack. I mean, the guy seemed pretty high strung to me and not terribly healthy. But so this is not, I'm not trying to be classy here. And this is probably the last time I'll ever mention Andrew Breitbart's name. And so, you know, the part of me that liked to argue with people, and I always had hoped that I would run into him again and argue with him more, feels sad. But, you know, my loss is irrelevant in this. And I don't think the world is significantly a worse place or a better place because he's gone. It's basically the same place as it always was. So... bye. And that will take us into the better half of the program. In which I will be talking about the story of a racist district judge. Well, he's not racist. He's just basically passing around a joke that says President Obama's mom not only had sex with black people, but also animals. I think a dog. And that story about a successful loan, energy loan. Energy development loan, actually handed out by the government, that may revolutionize electric cars. Update on, or I shall go into a little deeper on the resignation of Senator Snow. And if you want to make comments about Breitbart, I guess, up there I go. I've said his name. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. Folks, if you can become a member of the show, I thought yesterday, I thought my plea was particularly strong, but it didn't work. It didn't work. Please become a member of the show. You know, unlike Andrew Breitbart, I did not get $10 million in September to fund my... Well, I'm going to say it a bunch of times. This show may be the last time I say it. You got $10 million from an undisclosed donor. I don't get money from Ben and Jerry. I don't get money from Danny Goldberg. I don't get money from the Democracy Alliance. I don't get... The only person I get money from is you. Or would be you. You can become a member at majority.fm. It's not very much money relative to the show that we put on for free every day, but it also not only support that, but you get more content. You will see me in the better half of the program coming up now.